Hi there, welcome to our latest edition of The Front Page. I hope that January is treating you well. I hope you'll enjoy this wander through some of the big stories in horse racing at the moment. And we've got some real fundamental subjects affecting the sport in this week's edition, in which I am still, as was last week, Lee Motta said, and I'm joined by my colleague Scott Burton, our France correspondent in Paris. Bonjour, Scott.
Good morning.
And good morning to Chris Cook, who is very much here with me in the studio. All well with you, sir?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks.
Good weekend?
Jealous of the sun that's glinting off the side of Scott's face there.
Yeah, it's been a...
Haven't seen that for a few months.
No, a lot of fog. It's been a very foggy few weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's just frustrating a few weeks, really, if you're a jump racing fan. We can't seem to get a sort of decent Saturday's action put together, but hopefully that's about to change.
Thank heavens for force, lass. Scott, big burning issue. How much fog have you had?
Very little. Right. No fog. Actually pretty dry as well, actually. Just very cold.
Right. Good. Well,
right by me.
With that fog update behind us, we will move on to our first story. Chris, you had a whopper of a front page in today's Racing Post. Talk about that, please.
Bless you, very kind. Yeah, it was a really interesting story. I was talking to the BHA chairman, Joe Summers-Smith, one of the most important people in the sport. In fact, I think it was only a couple of years ago when you wrote the annual power list. Wasn't he number one?
Yeah,
a couple
would have
of
been,
years
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
Most important man, person, in horse racing. He's having the same problems that lots of other punters are having, fundamentally getting a bet on. His Betfair account, which is where he does most of his betting, he says, was suspended for 9 days. And he's had a couple of other accounts, frozen recently. So he spoke at some length about, what a dreadful experience that was, even though, he's that big a name within the sport. And you would have imagined that, he'd be flagged with every bootmaker that he's with, this is the guy who's the BHA chair, please extend him every courtesy. Just from the outside, you tend to assume that that's how bootmakers operate, that they've marked all the important people. He said that what happened was, this is what he thinks was the source of the problem. He'd phoned up one of their Betfair traders to say, here's this obscure tennis match, can you put up a market, please? And while the guy was sort of tapping away at his keyboard, he says to Joe, so how are you doing? And Joe says, well, I'm fine apart from, suffering from cancer, as he has been, unfortunately, for the past 18 months. And that appears to have triggered a series of checks initiated by Betfair, including they asked him, quite shortly after that for a copy of his passport, a utility bill, and a photograph of his debit card. The usual thing they get into in these situations, where they start asking for documentation so that you can continue to bet as you've been doing for decades. But he complied. He sent all that within about 20 minutes, and they referred him on to their safer gambling team. And there the matter stuck for the next 9 days. He's sort of desperately, sort of repeatedly trying to get in touch with them to say, can we get back to, when I was able to bet, please? There was a time arranged for him to speak to somebody and they didn't phone him. So just a poor customer experience all around. The end of it was when we got in touch with Betfair to say, we've heard from Joe Summers-Smith to say this has been happening. And within about an hour of us approaching them for comment, his account was unsuspended and everything's right as rain again. This focus of the story is on Betfair, but this, possibly could have happened in lots of different bookmakers. This is basically bookies responding to the pressure that they've been put under by the Gambling Commission in recent years to impose all sorts of checks on their customers, on pain of, all sorts of fines potentially coming down the pipes. And as Joe says, it's one thing for him. He's managed to get this sorted in a sort of relatively short time, thanks to the power of the press. He says there are tens of thousands of punters out there who are sort of going through similar frustrations all the time. And judging by his own experience, you could quite easily just give up and go and find something else to do with your time and your money, rather than begging bookmakers for the right to bet. So it's a really disappointing and frustrating story about what it's like to be a punter. Even if you're a really powerful guy like Joe, you can be presented with a difficult and unhappy experience.
I thought what was interesting as well, Chris, was it seemed as though Joe has been hit by two of the prongs that are really impacting punters. So on the one hand, you have this issue with Betfair, who are asking numerous questions about him in order for him to be allowed to continue betting. And we know punters have been hit with those in relation to affordability, in relation to anti-money laundering, in relation to Joe Seemley, whether they think he's in a fit state to bet. But he also speaks about how two of his other accounts, betting accounts, have been restricted by bookmakers. And we know, I've done tons of columns, we've all looked at this the issue of restrictions, whereby punters who are deemed to be winning a bit too much, or maybe just beating SP a bit too much, or just are a bit too good, a bit too clever for the bookmakers, are having accounts restricted. And again, the point that you made earlier on about you might think that if you're BHHA, you're going to get flagged up and not have the issue that he had. But again, with restrictions.
I know that people assume that about journalists as well. They go, well, I bet you have no problems at all. But there's a sort of random quality to it. You know, in the end, I think when Betfair have looked at this again, prompted by us getting in touch, you know, they've concluded that there's no reason for Joe to be suspended. And this has been a poor customer experience, you know, they're sorry about it. But nevertheless, it happened. And it's probably happened to lots of other people out there who, as I say, don't have the Joe's immediate power to get it fixed. So very worrying times.
Scott, what was your take on it when you read the story?
There were two things that occurred to me first up. The first is, I'm sure there is a very good reason why, if there's a serious health issue gets flagged, why that is deemed to be people who are expert in gambling harm would describe as marks of harm. I personally can't see what it is, and I think that's a fairly personal matter. Joe happened to mention it almost as a kind of throwaway line that he was undergoing treatment for cancer. It certainly wouldn't encourage me, or I suspect anybody else, to be all that candid with anybody on the phone in that circumstance if you think it's going to result in this kind of situation where he's unable to use his account for 9 days. So I think that's kind of quite worrying in terms of what does or doesn't constitute a fair amount of information for your bookmaker to have, really. I mean, it's between you and your doctor, really. You would share information with your employer because it may impact your ability to turn up for work. But I'm not sure how many other people you would choose to share that information with. The second thing was, obviously, this could have been anybody. In racing, it happens to be, as you say, one of the most powerful people. I think probably as somebody who obviously follows the political side of the sport pretty closely, I hadn't realised quite how invested, if you like, Joe Saumarez-Smith has been over a number of years in just the recreational side of betting. Mm. He mentions in Chris's article that he was actually one of the people invited along to Betfair's launch party. He's been on the exchange ever since it was launched, and clearly enjoys a wide range of sports. He is not actually allowed to bet on British horse racing because there's a kind of conflict of interest there, but he wanted to bet on Igish Fontec playing tennis. He bets on darts, cricket, rugby, all sorts of things. And I just couldn't help feeling that as much as when appointments are made to key positions, be it with the BHA or the Jockey Club or whoever it might be, we get told their kind of professional credentials and inevitably a line about, you know, lifelong interest in horse racing or whatever. But this actually showed a much more human side to Joe. And I think probably he might have... the BHA as a whole and his leadership of it might have been viewed in a slightly different light if we'd all known that he was essentially like the rest of us and just, you know, trying to back winners.
He definitely is as you said, clarified in the piece, he can't bet on racing now. Interviewing not long after he came into the job, and he was looking back through the piece now, he was telling me how he'd backed Kicking King Anti-Post to win the Gold Cup, and he'd won 100 grand on that, but also had him in a double with Penzance in the Triumph Hurdle, which yielded another 28 grand. He won 135,000 back in War of Attrition to win the chip. So, I mean, he was a proper, and he was betting 50 grand a week at the start of Betfair.
Yeah.
So he is a proper punter.
Yes.
And I suppose at the heart of what he's done here in reaching out to you to talk about what's happened to him is he's hoping that as a proper punter who happens to hold the most senior role in British racing governance, that might make a difference in shaping policy and actions within the Gambling Commission and government. Do you think it will?
So, I kind of feel that the Gambling Commission may be a lost cause. I mean, from the way they've been behaving, they don't seem to be open to persuasion that they're not actually right about everything. Outside of the Gambling Commission, you'd have to hope that you know someone as charismatic and persuasive as Joe would be able to make some headway, particularly with lawmakers. It humanizes this, and he says that you know he's found from previous discussions, some of these guys don't seem to really believe that this kind of restriction is actually happening. Well, there you go, he's living it, and I think probably we're going to get in the next few days some more examples of powerful people who've bumped into similar problems, and you know maybe we'll get some response from our readers as well, explaining again. You know we've heard from them plenty in the past. About the frequency with which this is an issue. And there's another betting story I've written actually in the last week, which is sort of tangentially relevant just because it's about how depressing the situation is for punters these days. I wrote about the story that's been quite well covered now about a betting syndicate managed by Rory Campbell, where the money just seems to have gone. And there are negotiations between the two sides about what happens next. The amount lost has been estimated between 3 million and 8 million quid. And that was sort of a bunch of heavy hitters who'd invested, more than 50 of them, various sums in his betting syndicate on the basis that he was making money betting on football, they hoped. But the point about that was that the betting seems to have been done with various Asian bookmakers. Because you know the heavy hitters involved, who are all very experienced gamblers, couldn't seem to find a way to get similar sums on with British-based bookmakers
in the regulated market.
So this is something that the Gambling Commission repeatedly says is at the margins. You know, people betting with unregulated firms overseas, but you know there you've got a story that proves you know you've got dozens of quite heavy hitting UK-based gamblers who are betting into unregulated firms overseas and just hoping that if they win then they're going to get paid, contrary to everything the Gambling Commission tells us, at a time when we see the betting turnover in horse racing has dipped, I think was it 20% according to the story we ran last month,
I think.
Over 2 years.
Yeah.
As many senior racing figures said at the time, you know, that this is a direct consequence of what the Gambling Commission's been doing. And some of that money is clearly going into the unregulated market, despite what they say.
Absolutely, and I think that clearly means that the Gambling Commission and the government have questions to answer based on this. But I think as well, a point I've made before is that bookmakers have a question to answer, because bookmakers, as a group, quite rightly, have spoken about how government policies, Gambling Commission policies, are forcing people into the black market, away from the regulated market, into the black market where they have no care and protection and where British racing doesn't benefit. But bookmaker restrictions have exactly the same effect. If you're someone who wants to back Constitution Hill for the Champion Hurdle, but is told you can have £2.36 on the horse and you can't get a bet on with regulated bookmakers, then we know that there are punters who are going to the black market. And therefore, bookmakers surely need to confront that as well. They need to confront their own actions in taking people in that direction, as well as what the government, the Gambling Commission.
No, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, from a punter's perspective, though, you're bumping into trouble wherever you turn, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the bookmakers that you blame or the Gambling Commission, It's a really difficult time to try and get a decent bet on a horse, unfortunately, and that does impact the sport. You know, it takes away reasons to be enthusiastic about the sport. It takes away the sport's funding. It's a real, real problem.
Yeah, it is a real, real problem, and it will continue to be a massive theme through 2025. We are going to move on to a problem facing British jump racing in part two of the programme. But first of all, could I direct you towards the great benefits of the Racing Post? Welcome back to the front page. We move on now to the Cheltenham Festival. Guess what? It's galloping ever closer to us. And we've had the first entries for this year's meeting. Last week, we had the initial horses in the list for the Gold Cup, the Champion Chase, and the Ryanair Chase. And the one that made the most headlines was in relation to the Cheltenham Gold Cup. And Scott Burton will explain why.
Well, perhaps we should say that the Gold Cup is Galopin's all, just because Galopin de Champ, obviously, on his way towards a bid for a hat-trick, the best mate hat-trick, the Arkle hat-trick, if you like, and he seems to have scared a fair few rivals off. 19 entries in the Gold Cup, which is a historic low, of which only five hail are trained from Britain. It's obviously a worrying number. I don't think anybody can really seriously be surprised, because they sat down and done the sums beforehand. You can't really say that there's any horse trained in Britain that should be in there that's missing on the whole. So Grey Dawning leads the home defence. I spoke to Dan Skelton at quite some length at the end of last week about Grey Dawning, how he's come out of the King George, but also about this wider topic of how few entries there were for the Gold Cup. And in fact, in some senses, the kind of the surprising omissions were all trained in Ireland. If you think about a couple of JP McManus horses, Spillane's Tower, and I know the way you're thinking. But Dan was very, very keen to point out that really the Gold Cup is one of those races that can really leave a mark on a horse if you go a year too soon. So certainly going back to the kinds of horses that you were talking about that Joe Saumarez-Smith had won money on in the Gold Cup back in the past, the Kicking Kings and the War of Attritions, we all think that you want a second season chaser straight out of novice company to win. But it seems that amongst the professionals, there's a definite thought that maybe, especially if you have a dominant defending champion, you might want to wait a year. So that's part of the explanation. He said, really, nobody from outside should criticise if a trainer or an owner has decided to either skip Cheltenham altogether, or in the case of Spillane's Tower, is obviously now one of the leading lights for the Ryanair. On the British front, he retains all his faith in Grey Dawning. He said things haven't gone brilliantly the first half of the season, but it's up to him to get the spring right. We might see him in the Denman Chase now. And then behind him, the home defence, kind of obviously Venetia Williams is going to have a big say. She's got L'Empressé, who was third in the King George involved, and also Royal Pagay. And then you've got the Real Whacker and Ahoy Senor. That fills out the British trained Pohall. I think the point I would make is that there's been lots and lots of quite positive noises about how the balance may be tipping a little bit back towards Britain with some of the better jump sources. We've seen some very promising novice chasers. It generally takes a few years for this to filter through, even if some owners have decided to have their better bought horses in Britain rather than Ireland. You'd want to see that in the novice hurdles and the novice chases before you'd expect that to start registering in these three senior chases. There was actually an increased entry of 26 in the Queen Mother Champion Chase. and the Ryanair was very, very well supported as well. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. 19 is quite an eye-opening number for the Gold Cup. And whilst it still looks a very, very good race, it probably requires nearly everything near the top of the market that's entered to get there in one piece. Galopin de Champs obviously very much leads the way, and he's put him on his train. Stablemate Factor File is next up. Jerry Colon, Banbridge, Monty Starr, all trained in Ireland before you get to Grey Dawning. And then there's the possibility of Ile Francais, who is, like Banbridge, entered in all three of those races over a variety of distances. You'd probably want to see most of those turning up, and then you'd say you've got a very, very good race. And even if it's only an 8 or a 10 run a Gold Cup, that would still be a mouth-watering prospect. We know that there are always a few leading lights that can fall by the wayside on the way to the Cheltenham Festival, and we probably can't afford for too many of those to be in the Gold Cup at this stage.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. And Scott, based on what you said there about the more promising signs for British jump racing among the novices, etc., and that was a point I referenced on New Year's Day at Cheltenham, where the vibe was pretty good among some trainers. Ben Pauling was particularly upbeat about Britain bouncing back in the future and talking about how British trainers were now better at sourcing young horses and maybe a bit more competitive in terms of grabbing horses when they come out of point to points. Because, as you say, if you look down the list of potential Gold Cup horses, there weren't really any more there for Britain. Are you more encouraged for British jump racing at this time this year than maybe you were 12 months ago?
I suppose on a theoretical level, yes. I think Ben Pauling was very, very balanced in what he said to you on New Year's Day. He talked about the way that you source these good horses. And there are only a limited number to go around in any given generation, whether they're bred in Ireland and come through the pointing field, or whether they're bred in France, or increasingly if they're bred in France, bought at the sales as a two-year-old store, and then turned back out again either as a three-year-old store in Ireland or in the pointing field. The two gene pools, if you like, are a lot more mixed than they were. But you're only ever going to get a certain number of real top notches in any given generation. And I think he was very interested in the way he said that some British trainers and owners, British-based owners, are now having to be a bit sharper in terms of the way they go about sourcing those horses in Ireland. I think France is another matter altogether. Obviously, there are plenty of good horses that go through public sales here. That is literally just a case of how deep your pockets are and how much you're prepared to go toe-to-toe with the owners who have trusted up to this point in Willie Mullins and Gordon Elliott and Henry de Bromhead. But also there's an awful lot of trade that gets done privately, and that requires agents on the ground talking to breeders, talking to trainers and pre-trainers, and getting in there first and potentially taking some risks in spending very, very good money on horses that have not been seen in public, because the minute you go and win a hurdle at Auteuil, Ile Francais is a very, very good example. Noel George and Amanda Zett at home had a British owner in Richard Kelvin who's lined up. They were at the races the day he won his first three-year-old hurdle, and they were able to go to the owner breeder and say, we will keep your horse in France. We've got an owner for you. That's how quickly these deals get done. I wrote a piece last April about a day at Auteuil, which previously as the likes of State Man have come out of it. So there's two very, very good newcomers races there. And there were almost more recognisable British and Irish agents at Auteuil than there were racegoers. You know, Charlie Swamp was there for JP McManus, Willie Mullins, key lieutenants, Harold Kirk and Pierre Boulard were both there. Toby Jones, who does an enormous amount of work for a number of different trainers in Britain. So they're all there, and it's just a case of fastest finger first, really. But I think it comes down to owners. If you've got owners who are prepared to back the British trainers, who are prepared to take a risk, because you don't know if a horse runs once at Otora, or a horse is bought as a two-year-old because it's got a great pedigree and all the rest of it, some of them aren't going to turn out to be any good. Some of them are going to be very slow, or they can't jump a hurdle or a fence. But that's the risk that Mullins and Elliott and De Bromhead and all of their owners have been taking in recent years, and that's why they've got the best material to work with. And the owners that have stuck by them have done so because they get, demonstrably, they get results. They come to the Cheltenham Festival. They are very good target trainers. They can have a horse that gets beat during the course of the year, but it turns up in A1 condition on the day, and you don't want to change a winning formula. So I am a bit more hopeful that there are some key investors who are looking at British trainers. Nicky Henderson has always had his very loyal band of trainers, but Ben Balling is now getting some interesting people. Venetia Williams does very, very well without spending spectacular amounts of money. I think that the training talent is definitely there, but it's a case of where people choose to spend their money. But it will take a few years for the wheel to turn again.
Hopefully, though, the wheel is turning now, Chris, for Britain anyway.
That doesn't bother me so much as the total number of entries for the Gold Cup. I mean, the getting down to 19 when only 3 or 4 years ago it was in the 30s, and I don't think it had ever dipped below that.
No.
It's very focused. And I think, I genuinely think there is a Galopin des Champs element to it this year.
Yes.
You know, the entries are published, you know, a couple of weeks after that really dominant display by him at Leopardstown. I can quite understand why people are looking at him and looking at the way he's won the last two Gold Cups and thinking, well, we just can't beat this horse. You know, do we run into a brick wall trying to take him on, or do we find a different target? Because there's plenty of other options. You know, if you've got some young up-and-coming horse who's maybe just on the edge, and you could sort of see him in a Gold Cup, but you're not quite sure if he belongs there yet. There's the array of handicaps. There's Fairy House and Punchestown and Aintree and a really serious array of options. And I think there's plenty. You know, whoever's got a horse in that situation is going to be looking elsewhere. It really might end up being a sort of 4 or 5 runner Gold Cup, because who's got the right to beat Galopin? The next few in the betting, you know, you'd say that he's already proved he's better than them.
And I suppose you referenced in your column last week that that's not unprecedented. Arkell's Gold Cup's never had huge fields. But I guess in that first one, was it 4 runs? You had Arkell v Millhouse. You had the dual aspect to it, which you wouldn't have this year. I absolutely accept what you say about the Galopin factor. But I was still surprised by some of the horses who weren't in the race, partly because we're about, 9 weeks yet off the Gold Cup? We know Galopin still has one race to go before Cheltenham. And we know that, you know, sadly, things do sometimes go wrong. And a lot of the horses who are towards the head of the market now for the festival won't run in those races.
Particularly when you're talking about staying chasers. You know, I mean, that would be amongst the most vulnerable categories of horses in terms of, you know, picking up a knock. And he's 9 years old now, which is sort of getting to the outer edge of what works in a Gold Cup. I mean, I think, you know, even this year, he'd be the oldest winner since Don Cossack. And there's only been 1 9-year-old since Synchronized in 2012. So that's what, how many years is that now? Quick calculate. Is that 13 years ago? Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So there's only been one horse as old as Galopin des Champs win the Gold Cup in the past 13 years. He hasn't lost any of his quality so far, and there's no sign of that. You know, he's been so well managed by Willie Mullins. I think by the time you get to next year's Gold Cup, you know, there's really got to be some anticipation that he will be on the sort of the downward side of his career. And there's going to be an opportunity there for, you know, young whippersnappers to take him on and perhaps catch him on a day when he's not at his peak. But I don't think there's really any faith or hope in amongst potential rival connections just now that it's going to be that way this March. So I do understand it, and I can accept that. But I'd really, for the sake of the race, I want to see a bigger entry by the time we get to this stage next year. It ought to be back up into the 30s, and if it's not, then we have to start worrying about, you know, what does this mean in terms of the production of top quality staying chasers? Do we have to change the entry system? You know, do we need to be closing it in January? Should we just leave it open? There's not many Gold Cup candidates emerged in the last 2 months before the race, we do have to start thinking about making sure that we're maximising the best possible Gold Cup field that we can have, Because when you're talking about sort of 7 or 8 or 9 runners, then one extra can make quite a serious difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the hope is that the Champion Chase entries have flipped around from a low to a relatively recent sure. high this year, so you'd hope the same thing. Scott, just before we move on, Il est Français, like Banbridge, is King George Conqueror, is in the Champion Chase, the Ryanair Chase, and the Gold Cup. As a man with his ear to the ground in France, with Il est Français, where would you like to see him go at the festival, and where do you think he'll go at the festival?
I've never been in the fortunate situation of owning a leg in anything that's been anywhere near the Channel Festival. It's easy for me to say, if you think you've got a horse that has a chance of running in the Gold Cup, I would say that's got 10 times as much cachet as not just the Ryanair Chase, but also the Champion Chase as well. I think if I've always felt if you think you've got a chance of staying the trip, you should have a go. I think it looks unlikely that he's going to thrive for an extra 2 furlongs on the evidence of what we saw at Kempton. But on the other hand, I don't see them racing back down to 2 miles. I think they'd be perfectly, if they thought they had a chance of winning a Ryanair, I think they'd do that. I think it's interesting that the horse, the race that they were talking about potentially taking in is what is now the Coral Gold Trophy. The Coral Trophy used to be the Racing Post Chase at Kempton. He clearly loves it around Kempton. I don't know if it's anything to do with going right-handed when he only ever gets to go left-handed in France, or it's just the kind of rhythmic nature of the way the fences come up, and it's usually reasonably decent ground there. So that's a route that François Dumain was never afraid to take back in the day. So that's to me suggests they want to have at least another go at 3 miles, and were he to win that, they might go for the Gold Cup. If you put me on the spot, I'd say I think he'll run in the Ryanair.
Yeah, I think so too. What do you think, Chris?
The suggestion is that he's been bleeding when he's under pressure in Auteuil. I think you probably don't want to go an extra 2 furlongs and put him under sort of Gold Cup type pressure if you've got that kind of worry at the back of your mind. But he, you know, a horse like him would add so much to the intrigue of a Gold Cup, especially if it always used to be dry ground at the end of the week for the Cheltenham Festival. It hasn't been that for a while, I think, but the Gold Cup traditionally was run on the best ground of the week, and if it was sort of good ground and drying out, then you know there's always that potential for a front runner who just keeps on going and never comes back. And he was such a thrilling watch in the King George. It'd be really interesting to see him in a Gold Cup and the pressure that would put the others under, you know, to try and judge when's the right moment to attack and can you even get to him if you want to. Yeah, I'd love to see it, but I don't know if it's the choice I'd make if I'm his trainer or his owner.
No, as journalists and fans, we can look at things in a slightly different way. Fans are at the very centre of any sport. The sport can't survive without them, and that's what partly we were looking at last week in our Project Spotlight series, which is our third story. Project Spotlight was in a way Racing Post version of something that the British racing industry is currently engaged in. That is called Project Beacon. It's being sold as the biggest customer research exercise the sport has ever undertaken, and they're hoping it will reveal answers about what the public, not just the racing public, but the general public feels about the sport and how that might therefore shape the sport in the future. We did our own bit of customer research last week across 5 days. We spoke to people, polled people, a small meeting at Lingfield and a quiet midweek meeting. We went to a big day at Sandown, Tingle Creek Day. We went inside some betting shops around the Manchester area. We sampled a music night at Salisbury, and I went walking around Kingston upon Thames High Street speaking to the general public about British racing. Positives and negatives came from it. One of the real positives for me was having gone to Lingfield on this quiet midweek all-weather meeting was the extent to which people really enjoyed the fair there. Now, in some ways, there's logic in that. You probably wouldn't go to a quiet day at Lingfield in cold weather, unless you really were going to enjoy it. But they absolutely did, and they also thought it was pretty good value, and they felt that a community developed around those smaller midweek meetings. The crowd at the big race day at Sandown, again, largely having a good time. There were the people who were there for the first time who weren't necessarily sure about things. One referenced not really understanding the odds as they were presented to, and that was something else that was drawn to us at Salisbury on the music night, with one of the race goers there, so they didn't really understand fractional odds, and that decimal would be better. I referenced that in my column today. It hasn't necessarily met a universally positive reception, it has to be said. Other negatives that came through during the week, though, actually one of the positives, I should say, that music night audience was largely very engaged in the racing, much more so than perhaps people might think of a music night audience. But in terms of where the sport maybe has more work to do, it was noticeable going around Kingston upon Thames just after Christmas, asking random people coming out of shops, going about their business, if they had any views, interest, enthusiasm for racing. The vast majority gave an answer akin to no interest whatsoever. Some expanded on that by saying that they didn't like the idea of horses being used for sport. Some had negative connotations about gambling. But even those that did have an interest in racing, there were questions for the sport there. One punter I spoke to, who'd had 500 quid on Constitution Hill at Kempton on Boxing Day, said his interest in the sport has gone down because, in his opinion, the quality of horses has generally gone down. And I spoke to a father and son. The son enjoys nights at Windsor, but again, asking them for, could they name some modern horse racing figures, celebrities? And the people that came up with range from Scobie Breasley for the dad, who wasn't a modern racing figure for decades, and the son mentioned the wacky guy with the whiskers who appeared on Channel 4, and John McCrurkey, sadly now the late John McCrurkey, has been on TV for a long time before he died. So not necessarily universally popular or positive response to Project Spotlight, but certainly raises issues for the sport to look at. Chris, looking at those pieces and what people were thinking about racing, there are things a sport can take from it.
Yeah, I don't know if I would be all that concerned about the lack of recognition. I mean, so going back 10 or 15 years, I might have been, but the audience for everything these days is so fractured.
Yeah.
Racing is a niche sport, you know, we have to accept that, but we still have a really healthy and sizable audience out there.
Absolutely.
Who are committed. And as long as we still do have new people approaching the sport, you know, as long as a percentage of the newcomers stick to the sport in the way that, you know, you and I did from a young age, then, you know, there's every reason to be positive about the future. Marketing is still a real issue. You know, that's somewhere where racing has always fallen down. You know, we've just never, ever invested in that in the way that it should have been done. And that's in as bad a situation as it's been for some time at the moment.
Actually, one thing that really highlighted that was within the Kingston piece, I spoke to one lady who said that one reason she hadn't gone racing is that she'd seen that the late Queen used to go racing. She occasionally sees horse racing on TV and just how people are dressed.
Yeah.
And she assumed it would be way too expensive, she said, for someone like me. Now, again, that's a marketing, isn't it? That is not telling people how racing actually is.
Well, and you know, if racing marketed itself a lot more, I don't know if it would necessarily address that concern, because I think it quite often, various elements of racing, they like to sell the sport snob value, you know?
Yeah.
They like to say, well, you dress up in your finery and come racing and have a great time. There's various different ways you can pitch yourself depending on what audience you're trying to reach. But I mean, the sports marketing arm hasn't had a chief executive for, I think, a year now.
Yeah.
And the budget has always...
Or permanent chief executive.
Yes. Yeah. And the budget has always been lower than it should be. And, you know, who knows how much money is being spent at the moment when it seems to be slightly rudderless. You mentioned Kingston. You know, I used to live not far from there.
Yeah.
So we both know, you know, this is a place that ought to know about horse racing, because you've got Sandown just there, Kempton just there, Windsor just along
Kempton
the river.
Not far away.
Yeah, all sorts of opportunities. Yeah. If you were the least bit interested in going racing, it's basically on your doorstep. So, I mean, yeah, perhaps recognition ought to be higher in that particular area. I still find myself feeling broadly positive about the sport. There's great action there to be watched. It's so accessible now. You know, if for punters at home, there's masses of information available. You can watch every race. If you were interested in bonding with this sport, it's never been easier to do so. Yeah. But we have to get the good word out there somehow.
Yeah, all good sense. Scott, lot to like, lot not to like in what the 5 day series revealed. A bit like Chris, were you broadly enthused by what you read?
I've always been of the opinion that if you come across anybody who knows more than just, oh, is it Grand National Day or whatever, that you're actually winning. I remember when the Racing Post was still based in Canary Wharf, which those people who know London well is obviously a financial centre full of plenty of well-connected, well-switched-on people who follow the events in the world, going out and doing a box interviewing people much as you did in Kingston. The day after See the Stars won his ARC, and therefore had won 6 Group 1s in a year, trying to find anybody who had something positive to say about it, and I could not find one person who'd even heard of See the Stars. And that's now 16 years ago this year, isn't it? Just gone 15 years ago last October. So I don't think this is a new problem. And I think some of the aspects that came up, as you say, at the music night, how engaged with racing some people were, I think a lot of the battle is getting people through the door in the first place, and then letting them be that on the television or at a race course or online or through their mobile phone or whatever it might be. And then at that point, not everybody's going to come back for a second look. But even if you get a small percentage of people who enjoy it and want to engage with it further, then, you know, a small percentage of a larger number is going to be helpful. So I think something that the Beacon Spotlight, Project Beacon has to throw up is, in terms of race goers, what the breakdown is between those people who maybe go once a year because it's on their doorstep. You know, they go to a Chester May meeting or a music night or a ladies' night somewhere at Huntingdon or Salisbury or wherever it might be. And those people who go very regularly, and whether there's actually much crossover in between, I suspect the kind of growth in racing's audience is to be found between those people who maybe go once a year already, maybe those people who save up and have a big day at a festival at Aintree or Cheltenham or Ascot or wherever, and to see how many of them are convertible to going along to a more regular day, but say a second festival day or potentially a big Saturday somewhere. How many of those people who can turn a once a year race goer into maybe a 3 or 4 time a year race goer? And I think that's potentially where any growth is in the sport, and hopefully the Project Beacon research will shed some light on how we get to those people.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we can, then there is a positive difference to be made. I think we've covered an awful lot there in this week's edition. It's probably time to wrap it up now, so you can all go and do something else. The winning story this week, I think realistically, our front page splash, or Chris Cook's front page splash today,
amazing,
about Joe Saumur-Smith talking about the issues he's facing, which so many other people have faced in the betting environment, deserves to be this week's winning story, particularly as you'd hope it might make a difference to the government and the Gambling Commission. So, Chris, you have the winning story.
Bless you.
My pleasure. And with thanks to Chris and to Scott. Have a great week there, Scott, in Paris.
Thank you. Will do.
And thanks to you for watching. We say au revoir, and we shall return this time next week. Bye-bye.